This edition of NewsHour Extra was first broadcast at 9 GMT on Friday, the 20th of November. And this week, we're looking at the Islamic State group trying to cover the organisation in a bit more depth so that we can all understand more about it. And we've got a great panel to help us do that. We've got Jason Burke, Guardian South Asia correspondent, author of a number of books on violent jihadism, including most recently The New Threat from Islamic Militancy. We have Jessica Stern, lecturer at Harvard, coming through from Boston. She's a consultant with various US government agencies on counterterrorism policy and the co-author of a recent book, ISIS, The State of Terror. We have Hassan Hassan, associate fellow at the London-based international affairs think tank Chatham House, and he also is the co-author of a book with a similar title, ISIS Inside the Army of Terror. And we have Giyos Al-Jundi, a Syrian writer and human rights activist. He was jailed for 4 years under the regime of Assad the father, not Bashar al-Assad, but the father, and now lives in London. And we're just going to look at a number of areas. First of all, the origins of Islamic State. And I guess the point to make about it is, one of the points, is just how quick this is, astonishingly fast, that this has all happened. We have a tape just from July 2013. I happened to be on air on the BBC World Service that day. And the other news that was going around on that day was Malala Yousafzai had just been honoured at the UN and Edward Snowden spotted in exile in Russia. So July 2013, not long ago, and IS suddenly emerged in Syria. And we began the programme that day with a story on that. I was talking with the BBC's Paul Wood. Sound of battle from Homs a couple of days ago. Government versus opposition. But for the opposition, there are other fronts to worry about. The battle against the government and the battle against each other. Senior Free Syrian Army leader Kamal Hamami was reportedly killed by people from an al-Qaeda affiliate called the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. I asked the BBC's Paul Wood, who's in Beirut in neighbouring Lebanon, to clarify what had happened.
To be honest, we have only the FSA's account, which is that Abu Asir, as he's known, that's his nom de guerre, was driving through Latakia with some of his men when he was stopped at a checkpoint run by the main al-Qaeda-linked group in Syria, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. They refused to let him pass and said he'd have to go back unless he got permission from their emir. He said he wasn't having any of that. He's a senior FSA commander and they had to let him pass. And more than that, they had to take the checkpoint down. A foreign jihadi, an Iraqi, pulled a gun, shot dead the FSA commander, whose men then simply had to retreat with his body. But this comes against a background, a long and deepening and increasingly bloody enmity between the jihadis and the relatively secular FSA.
Right. Is there any resolution? How do you see this being resolved?
It's not going to be resolved. There are very deep ideological differences between them. I mean, all of these fighters are to some degree religious, but the basic ideological division is between people who, although Muslim, want to have a civil state, but religion should stay out of politics. Against that, you have the jihadis who are fighting in Syria, part of a wider campaign to impose a theocracy there and on other countries. And I've been on the front lines with groups like the Nusra Front. I've come across Egyptians, Turks, Chechens. There are even said to be some British fighters, although I haven't seen them. And I'd say that while I come across a lot of them, groups like the Nusra Front, which is the biggest and most significant jihadi group, still seem to be predominantly Syrian, and certainly their emirs, their leaders, are Syrian. But there are many, many groups now. There are some 1,200 armed groups, according to one estimate, many of whom are jihadi, many of whom, it appears from the videos they post at least, are mainly foreign fighters. We don't know the numbers exactly, but I can tell you that the influence is probably disproportionate to the relatively small numbers of foreign fighters. They set the tone.
So there we are. That was just July 2013, and of course you can go back a bit before that to Iraq. But Jason Burke, this has been a very rapid formation of a very significant group.
It has deep roots, roots going back to 2003 and in some ways beyond that even. But certainly, yes, by 2009, 2010, 2011 even, the Islamic militants in Iraq were on the back foot, as Islamic militants were in general terms around the world. That was a time, you'll remember, Owen, that Osama bin Laden was killed in May 2011. Al-Qaeda was decimated in terms of its command and control. They had been, Al-Qaeda had been the dominant group, the pre preeminent group for a decade or more in terms of global jihad. And it looked relatively good as an overall situation. I was talking to senior security officials in UK and elsewhere and hearing them saying things like, if we'd thought it was going to be like this 5 years ago, we would have been very happy. What everybody was missing was what was going on in Iraq and the dual effect of the deepening civil war in Syria and the sectarian policies of Nouri al-Maliki, the Shia prime minister in Baghdad. And together that created a situation which allowed the group that became the Islamic State to mount a very clever, very aggressive campaign, a military campaign, but also a political campaign, a social campaign, where they exploited the sectarian tensions in the region. They exploited tribal divisions, commercial divisions, political divisions, and they put themselves in a position where tactically and strategically they were able to launch this extraordinarily rapid expansion, which culminated in the seizure of Mosul in June 2014 and the establishment of the Islamic State and the new so-called caliphate. And in a sense, it was certainly extremely rapid, but it was also, or it looked so rapid, because so many people had taken their eyes off the ball in the previous 3, 4, 5 years.
I mean, I do take your point that most people have taken their eye off the ball. There is, however, a fascinating Department of Defense memo, which was obtained through Freedom of Information legislation in the States from August 2012, talking about the possibility at that stage only of a Salafist principality. That was the phrase they used. Very interesting. Salafist principality in eastern Syria. So there were people thinking about it, but not really in the media and in the public discourse. So it did come as a huge surprise to many. Now then, let's bring in Hassan on this. You've written your book having interviewed people from inside Islamic State. Talk us through the ex-Iraqi military elements in it and how important they are compared to the religious ideologues.
Well, it's well known that the top echelon of ISIS is dominated by former Ba'athists who served during the Saddam Hussein regime in one way or another. And that also applies to some elements within Jabhat al-Nusra. In fact, for ISIS, the Saddamist elements within ISIS also should be viewed as religious zealots. They're not anymore secular Saddam.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. You think they've genuinely come around to this jihadi point of view?
There's no doubt that's the case. I think the process of transformation that these people went through is quite clear.
I was in Iraq in the 90s on a number of occasions, and the vision from outside was of the secular Ba'athist state of Saddam Hussein, whereas he'd already, by the mid-90s, worked out that the broad shifts in the rest of the Arab world were towards a much more religious posture, culturally, politically, otherwise. And he was tacking very much that way. I mean, I don't for a moment think that he himself was in any way pious, but he'd launched a faith campaign, as he called it. He'd talked about building the biggest mosque in the world. There was some huge construction underway in Baghdad that I used to go and look at. He talked about writing the Quran in his own blood. There was lots of religious programming on the TV. So at the same time, of course, you had the UN sanctions that were on Iraq. And I remember going to schools and hearing school children singing songs about the normal stuff about fighting the Zionists and so forth, but also against the US and the West and so on. And so, you know, the process of radicalization, if you like, or Islamization, was well advanced even before 2003, and an invasion that effectively ousted the Sunnis from their position of dominance. And I mean, just a very telling anecdote was when I was in Baghdad after the war, I spent a day with a insurgent fighter who was very much in that kind of Sunni nationalist mode. And he was clearly and professed himself to be a devout Muslim, but he still didn't like what he called the terrorists. So there were still all sorts of different currents at that stage. But I think it's certainly the case, as Hassan was saying, that a lot of the senior Ba'athists and a lot of the society more generally, Shia and Sunni, was very much more advanced down the path towards a religious resurgence than people think.
So, Ghiyasar Jundi, we just heard about Iraq and the religious elements of Islamic State and how that all relates to the old secular regime. How did it work in Syria? Is the IS pitch in Syria one of resistance to Assad or one of religion? What's the pitch?
I don't think the IS is resistance to Assad at all. We haven't seen any fighting between them.
Okay, now there's a lot of talk of is Assad sort of deprioritising the fight against IS while he deals with more moderate opponents. But just in terms of the pitch that IS is making, what is the pitch in Syria?
They are just trying to gain more and more in Syria, regardless who is the enemy. They are fighting everybody. They want to control the Islamic atmosphere in Syria. So the pitch is like they wanted to control.
And Jessica Stone, we're going to move this on to theology just now, but just in terms of what they control in Iraq and Syria, would you say it's almost reached its natural extent? Because it is partly it's a Sunni sectarian movement, as well as all the other things we're talking about, and they've got the territory that would naturally fall to them in under that guise, as it were.
Well, in fact, they've been pushed back somewhat. When President Obama said that the organization had been contained, he was referring to territory held by the organization in Iraq and Syria. But they've spread through their so-called wilayat, or provinces, in a number of places around the world, and that's part of the problem we face in fighting them. They have a wilayat, a province in Libya, in Egypt, in Afghanistan, in Nigeria. Boko Haram has pledged allegiance to them. They will be trying to spread those wilayat in areas with poor governance everywhere.
Yeah, it's very interesting development. But do you think it is a genuine global movement, or actually a regional movement with these things tacked on?
Well, of course, they've been able to entice youth who feel they want to reinvent themselves and remake the world around the world. I think that it is an ideology that has spread. Not, you know, obviously it's a very tiny percentage of people they've managed to seduce, but nonetheless, it's enough that it does pose a threat and does complicate our response.
Okay, so now we need to move on to understand more about the theology, and it is not really much covered in the Western media. This, I think, everyone's just so baffled by it that they're not really talking about it much. But it is quite important that the Islamic State does have a very distinctive view of Islam. End of days, apocalyptic. These elements are there, and they're very important. So let's just try and understand that. Hassan, can you talk us through this distinctive approach that Islamic State has to a final battle that they believe is coming? Just explain it to us.
I think the Islamic State's ideology should be situated in something that happened in 1989. That's when the founding father of ISIS, Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, moved out of Jordan, and he moved to Afghanistan to fight the jihad there.
Now, right, so just explain, this is a Jordanian who went to Iraq and founded al-Qaeda in Iraq. Yeah. So, yeah, him.
Before that, he was in Afghanistan, and that's when he first met Osama bin Laden. And since the beginning, there was a big difference of opinion between the two. Osama bin Laden believed in international jihad, focusing on the West as the far enemy, and this is the priority for al-Qaeda still. For Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi at the time, he immediately thought that a Shia should be the focus of our fight as jihadists. And he was pitching to Osama bin Laden and to al-Qaeda later, especially during the Iraq War, that they should shift focus towards Shia as the turning enemy. And he was citing how Shia throughout history have been the perpetual enemy of Sunnis. They were the cause of the downfall of the first Islamic State after the Prophet died. And during the Iraq War, he thought that Shia are the enablers of the American occupations. So his ideology is focused on this sectarian, narrow sectarian vision that in order to bring about a Sunni a global caliphate, you need to start with that premise.
Yeah, that's a very important element of it, the sectarian anti-Shia thing. But Jason, take us on to this end of days idea that they have.
Yeah, I mean, there are two things I think are really important here. One is a kind of mythic historical view, and the other is a slightly more or slightly less mythic historical view, if you like. And the former is about the apocalypse and how the great battle will occur between good and evil, belief and unbelief, and will occur in the near future or is occurring now. The second element is a historical element which is based in a particular vision of the last 1400 years of Islamic history, and that is the sense that once the Islamic empires were great, once the world of Islam was far ahead in terms of power, wealth, glory, scientific sophistication, literary sophistication, culture and so forth than anything in the West. And the two, in a sense, run parallel. The apocalyptic element you see in a lot of their statements, you see it in the name of their magazine, Dabiq, which is a village. It's actually in northern Syria, but it's where the end times are meant to start with this final apocalyptic battle. That's one of the reasons they've obviously called their magazine Dabiq, but it's also one of the reasons they spent a lot of time and effort trying to seize Dabiq as a strategic objective. This apocalyptic side of things works alongside this historical side of things and the sense that they're restoring to the Ummah, the global Muslim community, its rightful place as almost as a superpower. And the two come together, obviously, because you have the restored caliphate, the restored Islamic superpower. Well, they are obviously, they're going to fight the final battle against the powers of unbelief, primarily the West.
And this goes to
Hassan.
Exactly like Jason said, these two elements of ISIS ideology are going in parallel. But we have to understand the apocalyptic vision of ISIS today. Many of what ISIS is saying today about the apocalyptic end of days actually was mentioned by Abu Mas'ab al-Zarqawi, the founding father in Iraq. And every time they produce a new video, you see that statement by Abu Mas'ab al-Zarqawi saying that we will meet in Dabiq. And Abu Bakr Baghdadi, when he gave his first speech in the Mosul mosque, he kind of wanted deliberately to reflect that into his statement. The way he dressed, the way he talked, he wanted to kind of reflect that. He is the cause for the restoration of the caliphate.
Well, many people find this idea, I think many of the recruits find this idea of a final battle in a particular place, bringing the forces of Islam against the forces of the West. It's all going to come to a big crunch point in Dabiq. You know, it is appealing to many of the recruits. Ghias al-Jundi, when you hear this kind of material coming out of Islamic State, does it resonate in Syrian society at all?
I mean, when I lived in Syria, no, not at all. Maybe because of the oppression Assad imposed on the society in general and the Islamists in particular. So people were not able to express what they wanted to talk about. And also, at the same time, the Assad parallelly, like, created channels for the Islamists as well. Like, he, if you remember the beginning of the demonstration, the peaceful protest in Syria in 2011, the first thing he did, he released the Islamist and then he authorized an Islamic TV channel. But I couldn't feel that Syrian society was really about what we are seeing now in the videos.
It didn't come from society. Yeah, but yeah. Jessica Stone, let me bring you in on this. We've heard comments now that Assad was sort of encouraging radical jihadism, or at least sort of radical Islam, for his own political purposes. Saddam Hussein was doing the same thing. And it's often said that these Al-Qaeda and Islamic State forces do have sponsorship in some elements of some of the states who think they can use them. Do you think that is a fair analysis?
Yes, absolutely. I also think it's important to recognize that apocalyptic expectation has increased in Muslim-majority states. And I think ISIS is taking advantage of that. In 2012, Pew did a poll of Muslim-majority states, and more than 50% expected to witness the appearance of the Mahdi in their lifetime, 72% in Iraq, nearly 70% in Tunisia, where we see a lot of recruits. This apocalyptic expectation began among Sunnis after 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq. And we see apocalyptic expectation growing when people feel threatened. And I think that ISIS is taking advantage of that.
But it's more of an Islamic State thing than an Al-Qaeda thing, right?
It is. Islamic State is a much more populist organization, and they're trying to appeal to a popular audience. It's hard. You know, frankly, I've studied apocalyptic expectation among Christian groups, and I wasn't expecting this to be quite as extensive. as it is in ISIS's literature. Of course, we don't know how much they really believe this or whether they think it's a good way to recruit a certain segment of the population.
Hassan.
It's important to also realize that Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, again, he was influenced by a Jordanian-Palestinian jihadi ideologue, Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi. And Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi was directly influenced by a group of apocalyptic group that emerged in 1979 in Saudi Arabia, and before they surrounded and took over Mecca. And these people have, in apocalyptic sense, they share what ISIS believes in today, that the arrival of the Mahdi is near and that the Muslim world and the whole world is heading towards what early Islamic traditions foretold.
Right. And when you think about this, Ghias Al-Jundi, how important an element do you think this is, this end of days apocalyptic idea? How important is it to IS to have this?
I mean, it's important for the propaganda, mostly for the recruiting of young people across the Middle East. It appeals to the recruit just because it is there in the culture. And it is because of the frustration. I mean, I worked extensively in Tunisia for the last 4 years, and it appeals to the frustration in Tunisia's streets, to the West, who are coming to control us.
Jason Berg.
There was one very interesting point that everybody's touching on in a sense, but it's worth picking out, which is that one of the key differences between Al-Qaeda and IS, as we've heard, is the fact that Al-Qaeda were relatively disdainful, profoundly disdainful of the kind of very populist apocalyptic traditions that are so important to IS. And that's related to a generational shift and also to the background of the leaders of both organizations. And, you know, Osama bin Laden was trained as a civil engineer at one point, and Ayman al-Zawahiri was trained as a pediatrician. They were born in the 50s, grew up in the 60s and 70s in a very different environment. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is 20 years younger, was trained in religious studies, and is coming at this with a worldview that has been profoundly affected by the events of the last 10 or 15 years. And that shift, allied to the shift more broadly in the Islamic world that we've been talking about, is really important in understanding the rivalry between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, and also, as we're hearing, why Islamic State appeals so strongly to very young people across the Islamic world and into Islamic communities in the West today.
Let me just remind you, if you like this week's programme, do let us know. You can do that on Twitter at BBCNHExtra. Or if you don't like it, I should say, any comment at all, do let us know. Send us an email, BBCNewsHourExtra, all one word lowercase, at gmail.com. We've got a podcast. Just put into your search engine BBC News Hour Extra. It'll take you to a page which shows you how to subscribe, and it will come once a week, 1 hour, one topic every week. And from The Guardian, we have Jason Burke. From Harvard, we have Jessica Stern. From Chatham House, Hassan. And we have the Syrian human rights activist, Ghias Al-Jundi. And we're now just going to look a little bit at how Islamic State is governing, how they're actually administering the areas they control. And just to get an insight into that, I spoke to a BBC reporter in Baghdad, Ahmed Maher, and asked him, what are people who are leaving IS areas telling him? He's met many of these people. What are they telling him about the way IS governs?
Women there are not allowed outside unless they are covered in black from head to toe. Executions, people thrown off buildings just for suspicions of being gay, smoking, alcohol, all prohibited or haram. This is just a summary of life under the so-called Islamic State.
Social rules, I guess we'd expect that there would be very tight social rules. What about, though, administration? So in Mosul, would the government offices there, the local government offices, are they functioning?
Yes, this is another aspect of the strategy. The local government offices are functioning. They are paying the salaries to civil servants there. There's an estimate of 2 million civilians living and blending with IS militants. So the people there, they might be suppressed and they might be happy as well. And they might be sympathizing with their ideology because the overwhelming majority are Sunni. And of course, IS militants are Sunni themselves.
What's going on? I mean, are the Sunnis trying to leave or not, would you think?
The Sunnis there, they can't leave their homes. And those who are leaving Mosul, for instance, a group of Sunni Muslims went for Hajj in Saudi Arabia. They leave their title deeds for the houses and the homes with the emir or the governor as a guarantee that they will come back, because even if they are not accepting this interpretation of Islam, but they have to live under this new reality. But what we hear from the people who fled the city, that yes, indeed, there are many sympathizers. The statements posted by IS militants indicate that life is going as normal. People are buying food at discounted prices. People are happy. They are opening a stadium for football. So ISIS has become a fact on the ground, on the economic, on the political, on the military levels, and they have to live with it, and they have to deal with it, because there's no way till far to eradicate and to defeat ISIS.
And that was BBC's Ahmed Maher. So quite a mixed picture there, really, sort of saying that they are administering some things, but some people clearly would rather leave, but having to leave the title deeds to their homes before they leave the city, so they have to come back. So can anyone help us with what it's like in these Islamic State-controlled areas and how they're governing? Hassan, Hassan.
The most effective product that ISIS offers to the local population living under it is security. You know, I come from an ISIS-controlled area, and in 2013 I watched how that unfolded. When groups before ISIS, the Free Syrian Army and Jabhat al-Nusra, controlled these areas, they governed based on consensus and consent. They asked and expected the population to obey the rules and agree on sharing oil and running schools and bringing a criminal to justice and so on. When ISIS came and imposed its own ideology and its own rules as a state, because its claim is to be a state, so it started imposing taxes. It forced people who receive salaries still from the government to turn up to work, and the municipalities started to actually operate again. And people were saying that streets are now cleaner. For example, if you own a bakery and it's no longer lucrative for you to run the bakery, ISIS will ask you, why have you closed the bakery? And you will say, because I can't afford to do it. And what they do is basically provide you with the flour, provide you with the services, and then they force people to do
things. This is exactly what I'm trying to get at. How much is it good governance, like keeping the bakers open, and how much is it terror, just frightening?
Both. It's both. It's and both. They work in tandem. ISIS deters people and incentivizes them because many people don't see the alternative. In Iraq, the alternative is Iranian-backed militias who sometimes commit the same atrocities as ISIS. And in Syria, many people who rebelled against the Assad regime either believe that if they go back to the Assad regime will take revenge, or because they think ISIS and the way it governs is better than the regime.
Can anyone else help us with the nature of Islamic State governance?
Co-opting key local power brokers is very important.
This is Jason
as well.
Burke, speaking from Delhi.
Because you can build consent, or you can scare entire populations, but one of the most effective ways of controlling a community is to find its leader and, in the very mafia way, make him an offer he can't refuse. ISIS have been clever at finding ways of appealing to particular groupings or particular individuals who can help them in particular localities. And that might be for tribal reasons, it might be for sectarian reasons, it might just be for particular reasons on the ground, it might even be for commercial reasons. So, for example, the big smuggling networks that stretch through Syria and into Iraq, running into Baghdad and then on beyond, actually, down which you can move pretty much anything illegally, are run by the big local tribes, and they want to keep running them. And anyone who can help them keep running them, they will quite possibly support. And ISIS have been very good at reaching out to some of these tribal leaders, offering them basically a deal that they will guarantee the security of the convoys and the smuggling routes as long as the tribes are brought on board, or those particular communities come in, line up behind ISIS. I mean, there are other things going on as well, sectarian and so forth. But that's a useful way of co-opting local leaders and playing on all those really granular local factors that only people on the ground are going to know. And that is also key to the ISIS system of governance.
Okay, so Gio Sargenti, do you agree with that? It's smart politics as well as violence.
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, I just came back from Lesbos, from Greece, and I interviewed so many Syrian refugees who fled because I wanted to know who was fleeing Assad's control and who was fleeing the ISIS. And they repeated what Jason was talking about. ISIS choose criminals or ex-secret services or ex-criminals under Assad control, and they make them the boss in the area.
Right, so quite a frightening local power broker.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Jessica Stern, I mean, if that's the case, you know, how sustainable is this? I mean, if they're governing through fear to some extent, and even to a large extent, then that's not terribly sustainable, is it?
Well, I don't think it's indefinitely sustainable, but there is a wellspring of disenfranchisement to capitalize on. And I think that is the main problem. And also the sense of feeling secure, more secure, protected by this organization than anybody else. I mean, it's a kind of protection racket, like a mafia.
Okay, let's just move this on now to look at what some people say is one of the goals of Islamic State, which is to create division in Western societies and to make Muslim communities in the West feel more vulnerable and to get more recruits that way when people are forced to make a decision between the West and Islam and end up choosing Islam. So hopes Islamic State or their version of it. And so this is often stated as an IS goal. We've got some tape here, which suggests it may be happening. President Barack Obama has described as hysterical the actions of some state governors in the United States who are refusing to resettle Syrian refugees. He said some Republican rhetoric on the issue was a potent recruitment tool for Islamic State militants. And we've got now a little montage of some of the Republican candidates who are standing, hoping to become the next U.S. president.
Our president wants to take in 250,000 from Syria.
You can have 1,000 people come in, and 999 of them are just poor people fleeing oppression and violence. But one of them is an ISIS fighter. If that's the case, you have a problem.
The director of national intelligence here in America has said of those refugees in Europe, it is clear that a significant number of them may well be ISIS terrorists. It makes no sense whatsoever for us to be bringing in refugees who our intelligence cannot determine if they are terrorists here to kill us or not.
Congress, I think, should defund all the programs that allow these people to be brought here immediately, today.
It is the war of our time and a struggle that will determine the fate of the free world. The United States, in conjunction with our NATO allies and more Arab partners, will need to increase our presence on the ground. We can't withdraw from this threat or negotiate with it. We have but one choice, to defeat it.
So there we go. That was Jeb Bush at the end. You also heard from Donald Trump, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz and Ben Carson. Let's just stick with the point about Syrian refugees, Jessica Stern, as you hear this kind of rhetoric coming from the United States. What impact is it having on the debate and on the feeling of vulnerability of the Muslim community in the United States?
Well, I am hearing that some Muslims in the United States are feeling threatened. They are feeling very ill at ease because of this kind of conversation, but also because the way people are reacting to them in their ordinary lives. And this is exactly what ISIS aims to achieve. They want very much to sow discord between Sunni and Shia, between Sunni and ISIS, the Salafi jihadists of the ISIS variety, and especially between Islam and Rome, as they put it, the West. They want Muslims living in the West to feel unsafe. That is their goal. And, you know, I think it's really important to remember that terrorism is psychological warfare, and we want to be very careful not to fall prey in the way they hope we will. Yes, ISIS is based on Islamic texts, but it is not Islam. It is their version of Islam.
Giyas Al-Jundi, do you recognise what you're hearing there from the United States? You're here in the UK. You must know the Syrian community here in the UK. Is there an increased feeling of vulnerability?
I mean, yes. I have been working for 4 weeks in Lesbos, and I feel the refugees coming to Europe are scared, terrified of the statements appearing from here and there, mostly from the right-wingers in Europe, the far-right-wingers, who are, from my point of view, like the Islamists. They exploit every opportunity to spread their ideology as well, or their election methods. People are afraid. I mean, I have so many friends who wanted to travel, for example, to Greece from France, who are Syrian refugees, and they told me I cancelled my trip because I'm afraid. They are afraid to be stopped in the airports. They are afraid to speak to people. And some people posted on the Facebook in France and Germany that we're trying not to go out. There's a chaos, I mean, a mess in the atmosphere, and then everybody's affected.
OK, well, intercommunal relations in the West is one issue, and there is another bigger thing we need to talk about, finally, which is the state of this conflict between radical Islam as interpreted by IS and the West. And there are an increasing number of voices. We heard Jeb Bush there saying this has got to be fought. Many people in the American military feel the same way. Retired General Jack Keane has been testifying to the House Foreign Affairs Committee, saying that so far the American response has been totally inadequate, calls for boots on the ground. So let's get a flavour of that. This is former NATO Supreme Allied Commander Europe, Admiral James Stavridis, on what he thinks is needed to defeat Islamic State.
I think we would need to add a significant component of special operations troops immediately to go on the ground. And this could come from all of the NATO nations working through the NATO Special Operations Headquarters, which is located in Belgium and has global capabilities. Secondly, we'd amp up the intelligence collection and intelligence sharing. Third, we would increase our presence in the cyber world using all of the NATO members who have that capability. Fourth, we would increase the bombing campaign. Believe me, adding all of NATO's capabilities to what is already in place would be a significant increase. Fifthly, we would move to train the Kurdish forces, and there are 150,000 Peshmerga operating in the north. We would re-energize the training program with the Iraqi security forces, recognizing the frustrations and the failures there. But ultimately, when you put Peshmerga from the north, Iraqi security forces from the south, you have a significant capability to balance with the combat bombing campaign. And then seventh, I'd say Turkey's army, the second largest in NATO, would have to step up in this scenario. So total of troops, I would say about 15,000 NATO troops, excluding Turkey, which I would hope would have a larger land contribution to make. I think when you put all that together, you have the means to take on the Islamic State in a significant way.
So that's James Stavridis, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. Jason Burke, what do you think of what he's proposing?
Well, it's all very, as I say, kinetic, i.e. involves the application of extreme force, which is not such a bad thing when you're fighting viciously brutal Islamic extremists. There's clearly a great advantage in killing a lot of them. The question is then what you do afterwards. And you're going to move, as he was talking about, large numbers of troops in, or what exactly the Turks going to do, how the Kurds going to work it out. I mean, what he didn't talk about was the diplomacy and the governance, because the problem is that, yeah, you definitely need better intelligence. Special forces on the ground, good idea, especially with the intelligence together. You can then direct the bombing he was talking about. All that goes together. You can use the Kurds, good fighters, lightly armed, increasingly better trained, all the rest of it. They can hold ground. But you're still going to have a fundamental problem. And if you look not just at Iraq and Syria and ISIS, but you look across the entire Islamic world and beyond, you look at where Islamic militancy is thriving, it is where there is weak governance. And that goes for Yemen, that goes for Libya, that goes for Boko Haram down in Nigeria, that goes in the other direction out into Afghanistan. That is basically the key. If you want a lasting solution, then you need to restore some kind of government in these areas. Now, that's only going to be done, certainly there's a military component, but what is absolutely crucial is diplomacy at the moment with Iraq and Syria, and strengthening those governments on the ground in places like Nigeria, or indeed Afghanistan or elsewhere, where we have useful partners on the ground who can take back this territory.
And Hassan, what do you make of the argument some people make that this is what, yeah, if a big ground force, if this air war is turned into a ground war, that's what Islamic State wants, and it would rally mainstream Arab opinion, saying there's another imperial Western army on the way.
Absolutely, and this is exactly what ISIS is trying to do. Many people in the beginning, when the Russians intervened in Syria, they said the Islamic State would try to avoid provoking the Russians. But they did exactly that by attempting, allegedly, bringing down the Russian airline. I agree with Jason. I think there are three options that the anti-ISIS coalition has. Two good ones and one bad one. And I think the former NATO one laid out the bad option. I think that's the worst possible strategy.
Lots of force.
Lots of force. Yeah. And he didn't mention diplomacy, as Jason mentioned. And that's the bad option. The two good options is either continue with the current measured campaign against ISIS, which weakens the organization in the hope that a political solution, a political track will emerge in both Iraq and Syria and try to kind of start to resolve the conflict in both countries. The other good option is to go all in and start a heavy-handed military approach, but pegged to a political track that is really serious and seeks to resolve the conflict in Syria and Iraq. Without doing so, increasing the rate and scope of airstrikes in ISIS-held areas is only worsening the situation. We're already seeing signs of people turning closer to ISIS because of the airstrikes disrupted a wartime economy that was functioning way before ISIS came.
Yeah, so it does mean that the options are very limited. I mean, Jessica Stern, someone made the point that, you know, not many people are actually fighting ISIS. The Turks have more problems with the Kurds, and that the Saudis have more problem with Iran. The Kurds who are fighting ISIS only want to do so to a certain degree. Once they've got their land, they'll be happy. So talk us through that the regional politics mean that ISIS actually is almost in a vacuum and able to survive.
Well, ISIS is unique in that it has enemies everywhere. There is no nation. It has no allies. And yet we do see Saudi Arabia, which I think is quite threatened by this ideology, much more interested in fighting a proxy war with Iran in Yemen. King Abdullah of Jordan has said this is a Sunni Muslim issue. The Sunni Muslims need to respond. They need to be taking the lead militarily. And yet we don't see that. Until we have an end state for Syria, we can't solve the ISIS state problem. But there's also the issue of the spread of the ideology. We need to get much better at undermining their narrative. They're offering a so-called five-star jihad to foreign fighters. They're offering salaries to people on the ground, better salaries than they can find elsewhere. But also they claim to be offering a utopia. There are people who have been there who managed to escape and say, this is nothing like how it's advertised. It is not a utopia. The barbarism, the corruption is not what we're being told ISIS offers. We have not yet found a way to spread the words of those formers, especially to youth who find the reinvention of the world, reinvention of the self through ISIS appealing. We need to get a lot better at it. And yes, there are hundreds of learned Islamic scholars, imams who have taken on the ideology, but they're not, that message is not getting to the youth who find ISIS attractive. We need to get better at appealing to them.
Yeah, but mind you, people have been saying this for many years, haven't they? It doesn't seem to happen.
True, but I think part of it is that governments are not the best entities to do this. I think we need to see the private sector getting involved.
Yeah, let me put you on the spot a bit here, Sergeant. We've just been hearing about the regional politics and how it plays into all of this and the extent to which IS is a target or not for some of the local regional powers. From your point of view, you were put in jail by the Assad regime, and I'm sure you had a very bad time in prison there. Could you tolerate the continued existence of Assad for, I don't know, 6 months, some years, in order to allow people to focus on fighting Islamic State?
No, not because I have special hatred or personal hatred, because I strongly believe that Assad, behind the existence of ISIS in Syria, he wants to push the West to compare between him and the ISIS, what are we having now? Look at Palmyra.
Okay. You may not like his tactics, but they do. Yeah. If let's say you're right about all of that.
Yes.
He has succeeded. And the West is now faced with a choice between Assad and Islamic State. Yep. And in that situation, the West is going to choose Assad, isn't it? And probably should.
There are so many people in Syria can replace Assad and cooperate with the West to fight the ISIS properly. He is the dividing figure in Syria now. Let's keep the state and release Assad from that place.
Okay, so let me just finally ask you this, because it's so difficult to work out what's happening. And I'm going to put this to all four of you just in turn. Where will this be in 5 years' time, actually? Where are we going to be in, let's say, 2020? Let me go to you first of all, Jessica Stern.
I wish I had a crystal ball. I can't say that I have a sense of where we'll be in 5 years. I do have a sense of where we'll be in 20 years. Looking at the history of terrorism, terrorist groups do not last. They lose their ability to appeal to a broad audience. And I am sure this will happen eventually. I don't know whether it will happen in the next 5 years. I'm very curious what my colleagues will say in response.
It's a slightly slippery answer, but we're letting it go. 20 years rather than five. Jason Burke.
I certainly agree with Jessica in that from the outside, this looks very strong and stable, and the Islamic State appears to have a great deal of momentum. I think the chances of the Islamic State lasting longer than 2, 3, or 4 years is relatively slim, that it will fragment rather than disappear entirely, particularly if Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is killed. That would cause some major problems. If they come under significant pressure, that will cause some major problems. One key thing is they have to keep expanding. They have to have that momentum of going forward. If not, the whole project collapses. A caliphate, which is doing God's work on earth as they project it, to convince has to show evidence that that is what is happening. Once it starts to go badly for them, I think the support will hemorrhage quite rapidly, and they will be much less attractive to young Muslims in the West and elsewhere. But that is a relatively long process. I think it will take 2, 3, 4, 5 years. But by the end of 5 years, I'd be surprised if they still existed in the same way today. My caveat would be, rather than sound too optimistic, is that what comes afterwards will be pretty nasty, because it will be very fragmented and very dispersed. And the broader movement of Islamic militancy, which we haven't been able to talk about in the way that would have been good to, because it's still important, it's still very broad, it's still very deep, will still very much be there.
Thank you very much. Jason Burke, Giyas Al-Jundi.
I think the ISIS will not last. Any political solution in Syria, like removing the regime as it is now and stopping the war, would be the beginning of the vanishing of ISIS. They are mostly foreigners, especially the ones who are terrorizing the communities are foreigners. So I think they will not last for 5 years, and I hope so.
So Hassan, we're hearing predictions of IS demise. You know, maybe the timescale is not clear, and Jessica thinks it may take a long time. What's your take?
Well, I come from the position that ISIS will stay with us for another decade. I try to stay in touch with people on the ground in ISIS-held areas on a daily basis, and I think people underestimate how resilient the group is. People are talking about how financially affected the group is, but at the same time, they forget that ISIS took Mosul, took Tal Afar, took Ad-Dur, and took many key areas, including Fallujah, without controlling any oil field. I think American officials in private recognize that the Iraqi forces and especially the pro-government forces are beaten and tired. They don't want to fight, especially in Sunni areas. Recently, after Tikrit, which is a Sunni city, they lost 6,000 fighters after government forces launched a campaign with 35,000 forces, and it took them a whole month to get rid of ISIS. They lost also appetite to fight against ISIS. And there are so many other factors that I don't have time for to kind of lay out, but I'm convinced that ISIS will stay with us for another decade at least.
Quite resilient. Thank you all very much. Hassan, thank you. And also to Jason Burke, Jessica Stern and Giyas Al-Jundi. Don't forget, NewsHour Extra, it comes out every week. One topic for 1 hour each week. You can get it on a podcast, so you should never miss an edition. That is BBC NewsHour Extra into your Google search engine or whatever. That will take you there. And you will be able to subscribe to it. Come onto whatever device you choose. And then on Twitter, we're at @BBCNHExtra. And you can send us an email. For that, it is BBC NewsHour Extra, all one word, at gmail.com, and we try to reply to all the emails you send in, so do that. But for now, that's it. Thanks for listening, and from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London, goodbye.